This is The Guardian.
Today, a six-year-old boy killed by the people who are meant to care for him. What can social services learn from the case of Arthur Labinio Hughes? Just a quick warning before we start. This episode does include disturbing descriptions of child abuse. The death of six-year-old Arthur Labinio Hughes in Solihull in the West Midlands has been so horrifying, you might have done your best to avoid learning about the cruelty inflicted on this little boy.
For a child to say to his own dad, "I'm in danger with you, Daddy," he must have had this sense of impending doom that something was going to happen to him.
And yet, Arthur's tragic story isn't a one-off.
Last year, around 55 children were killed as a result of abuse or neglect. So it's happening all the time. But occasionally, one case like this will come to the fore and catch the imagination, really, of the public.
The Guardian social policy editor, Patrick Butler, has been following Arthur's case and what it exposes about Britain's social care system. Last week, Arthur's father and his father's partner were sentenced to 21 and 29 years for manslaughter, murder, and child cruelty. There's been an outpouring of grief, shock, and outrage. And now, the government has launched an urgent new inquiry on social services.
No government anywhere in the world can legislate for evil, but we will take action wherever we can to stop it from happening again, because we must do more.
From The Guardian, I'm Nosheen Iqbal. Today in Focus, after the death of Arthur Labinio Hughes, can a new review of child protection services reform a system under strain? Patrick Butler, you're The Guardian's social policy editor, and you've been reporting on the tragic death of Arthur Labinio Hughes. And we've seen his image all over the front pages, this smiley little boy who suffered such a tragic end to his life. What can you tell me about what he was like?
Well, what we know about Arthur was that he was from Solihull in the West Midlands. He was at primary school. He was into comics. He was into Marvel heroes. He was into Birmingham Football Club. And he was in many ways a typical, bright, bubbly six-year-old. We also know that he had had quite a troubled life.
Up until early 2019, Arthur had been living with his mother, Olivia Labinio Halcrow. And that year she stabbed and killed her partner and was jailed for 11 years. What happened to Arthur after she was sent to prison?
What happened to Arthur was he had to move from his mother's house to his father's house, Thomas Hughes, his dad, 29. He took over the care of his son. And several months later, he met a woman, Emma Tustin, who was 32 online. And they decided actually to move in together in March 2020, just when lockdown was announced.
And we now know that not long after that is when the abuse really began for Arthur. When did Arthur first come to the attention of social services?
He didn't come to the attention of social services till after March, but if you scroll back a couple of months, back in November 2019, Thomas Hughes had met staff at Arthur's school to discuss their growing concerns about his behaviour. Arthur was becoming a bit fixated with his dad disappearing or his dad killing him. He'd become a bit obsessed with death and murder and guns. And this is clearly a boy who is not very happy. Not long afterwards, March 2020, just before lockdown, the father takes Arthur to child mental health services. And according to the court reports, that the mental health services said that Arthur's physical appearance was fine, his aggression and anxiety had reduced, and so she concluded there was no mental health issues. Now, what happens next is lockdown is announced. Arthur and his dad move into Emma Tustin's house in Solihull.
And what do we know about the period leading up to Arthur's death?
In that short period between March the 20th, when he moves into the house, and his death in June, there were a number of referrals made by worried relatives and friends to various agencies. For example, in April, Arthur's uncle spoke to West Midlands police because he'd seen bruises on the boy's back, and he took photos and he sent those to an officer. The next day, social services visit the home, and it appears that they have spoken to Arthur and his father. The social worker appears to have said that they seemed happy and there was no need to refer the case to a formal child protection assessment. Then there was a referral to the police also from a relative. There was a referral to school, but the final referral, the fourth, was on May the 20th, less than a month before he dies. There was a referral made anonymously to social services, and it appears that no action was taken.
And we know that weeks later, Arthur died. Patrick, what happened?
What he actually died of was unsurvivable brain injury. But this was the culmination of really what was a campaign of appalling cruelty. They found 130 injuries on his six-year-old body. Arthur was effectively starved. He was poisoned with salt. He was assaulted. The prosecutors in the case called this the very definition of child torture. And they talked about Arthur being forced to sleep on the floor, for example, without a mattress. He was forced to stand in the hallway for hours on end. It's almost overwhelming, and it really does beg a belief that this could go on.
It's just so difficult to comprehend. And yet, this case is even more unusual and horrifying because the abuse was documented in so much detail. Some of the key evidence from the case seems to come from CCTV that Emma Tustin had installed in her living room, showing hers and Thomas Hughes's abuse of Arthur, and from phone recordings that she made of his suffering. How much did this have a part to play in uncovering the truth of what happened to him?
I suspect it played a huge role.
Ambulance service, is the patient breathing?
Barely.
Okay, is he breathing right now, though, even if he's...
Is he breathing, Tom?
There was this collection of around 200 audio recordings in which we heard Arthur plaintively crying, "No one loves me," or "No one is going to feed me." I mean, this is truly, truly, truly awful. It's not entirely clear to me why that footage was taken, but I think it's probably gone a long way to ensuring that the public's sense of horror at this case is ratcheted up another couple of notches.
The government has now announced that there's going to be a national inquiry of child protection services to work out what mistakes were made. This is not the first time we've seen this sort of response. Over the years, there have been similarly tragic cases to Arthur's. The case of Victoria Clambier led to an inquiry by Lord Laming in 2003. The killing of baby P, Peter Connolly, in 2007 led Laming to a second urgent review of child protection. Harry Ferguson is a professor of social work at the University of Birmingham and someone who has studied the impact of these landmark reports. Harry, first of all, just how difficult is the job of a social worker?
Very difficult. I was a social worker doing this kind of work many, many years ago. So, you know, I think what people need to understand is that doing social work and child protection work, it's different to doing other kinds of sort of helping work like psychotherapy or counselling or a GP. You know, patients, clients go to their offices. Where social work and child protection work primarily goes on is in the family home. It's a very kind of sensory experience in terms of what it feels like to be in the home, how welcoming is it, how hostile is it. So having stepped into a family home, social workers have a lot to achieve. They've got to observe the children in interaction with the parents. They've got to engage with the parents, talk to the parents. They need to see the children on their own. Often there are distractions like pets, people in the home, you don't know who they are, other adults. The TV's on. So, yeah, it's a very, very complex series of challenges that workers face to try and reach their core goal, which is to find out, yeah, what's happening for the children in this family.
Can you tell me when you first heard about the case of Arthur Lobinho Hughes?
I first heard about it on the news. I was shocked. In different roles, I've been involved in social work and child protection for over 40 years. And I think the thing that really moved me particularly about Arthur's situation was the visual images and the audio recordings. I think it's just the most vivid evidence, if you like, of the kind of lived experience of what it's like to be an abused child.
Harry, you've written an article for The Guardian in which you identify two major factors in Arthur's case that could have led to social workers not being able to do their jobs fully during the pandemic. One is the fact that schools were closed, and the other is that social distancing measures came in. Can we start with school closures? What impact do you think they had on how social workers did their job?
I was part of a research team that got a grant to look at the impact of COVID on social workers' capacities to keep children safe in the pandemic. And we spent the first 9 months from March to December in 2020 interviewing a sample of workers every month. And technically, schools remained open for children who were recognised as being at risk. But it was very, very common, we found, that for parents in such cases not to send the children to school. So what it meant was that schools ceased to be an option to see where children could be seen on their own, and nobody was allowed to go into anybody's home. So what social workers did was they do doorstep visits. They would see them in their gardens. Video calling became very popular. But it was absolutely clear that where there was significant concerns about the safety of children, that social workers needed to go into the home to see them.
There is a tendency to blame social workers after a horrible tragedy like this, to say that there is a lack of professional curiosity which is at fault. But how much can individual social workers be held accountable when a child is abused in this way?
Well, I think the urge amongst the public, too often as well amongst politicians, is to blame social workers, to hold them fully to account and to sort of interpret what's happened as a result of their poor practice, their incompetence, you know, their lack of moral fibre. From the research I've done anyway, where social workers make mistakes, it's much too simplistic to hold them responsible for the mistakes that have been, the errors that have been made. Sometimes, you know, there are weaknesses in individual practice, but you've got to look at the way the whole system is implicated.
As part of this inspection, all the agencies tasked with protecting children at risk of abuse and neglect in Solihull will have their effectiveness considered and instructed on where improvements must be made, both in Solihull as well as where learnings can be applied to other areas around the country.
Coming up, what lessons can be learnt to ensure we never see a case like this again? Patrick, in Arthur's case, as we've discussed, family members did express concern and reported those bruises and signs of abuse. Where do you think social workers seem to miss opportunities to try and stop what was happening?
This is really hard to say. I mean, one can speculate, but I think what's going to be fascinating about the review that's taking place now is that those reviews will look forensically at every single decision that was made. All the professionals involved, whether that's social work or police or health or teachers, they will all get a chance to explain why they did what they did, when they did. And I think that's really the only time when you can build up a picture of why things happened and why things didn't happen, for that matter.
In your reporting, you spoke to Robert Halfen, the MP for Harlow and the chair of the Education Select Committee, and he has insisted in Arthur's case, and I quote, every single one of them has to be held accountable, from the local council chief executive to the director of children's services, to the people who came round to the house. Every single person should have to answer for what decisions were made. Now, Harry Ferguson has told us about a culture of blame that is counterintuitive to getting the best from social workers. But how can a balance be struck between making sure the profession is supported, but is also held to account in some ways when things go wrong?
I think we have to be really careful. And when Robert Halfen made those comments, I sort of could understand where he was coming from, because a lot of people will feel that this is an outrageous case, that mistakes were obviously made. But I think let's not make any assumptions about who did what and when. I think Harry Ferguson is right. I mean, what we saw in Baby P was that there was an absurd overreaction in terms of sackings and the media bullying the director of children's services at Haringey, Sharon Shoesmith. There were a handful of social workers who were vilified in the press. And one of the impacts of this is that becoming a social worker became a very, very high risk occupation. Not only were you doing a job where if you make the wrong decision, you're going to have to live with the fact that maybe a child was hurt or even killed on your watch. If you make a bad decision, then you're going to be vilified. And in the cases of those people, their careers ended and their lives turned upside down. And so I think we have to be really careful about establishing really what happened. And I think we also have to bear in mind that often, when people are determined to do the kind of horrible things that they did in this case, it's really hard to stop them. I mean, we're talking about people who are often very manipulative, often very sly, and they're expert at avoiding scrutiny. And I think the other thing we have to remember, the context of how social workers work, is that this is a very high-stress job to start with. It's not a very well-paid job. You don't get a lot of thanks or status for this kind of job. And we know that social workers often working in child protection might have, in some councils, be looking after as many as 30 at-risk kids. You probably want a social worker to be looking after no more than 10 kids. But where you see, as I mentioned before, you have this increase in demand, you have fewer resources, you're talking about very stressed occupation at the moment.
When there is a story like this and it provokes this sort of national outcry of just horror and shock, the government often responds by launching a review. How much do you expect in this instance that it will have an impact on the profession itself and actually change the way social work is done, if that is what is needed?
One would hope that it will be positive. The national review means that it's going to look at the implications for the whole system. One hopes that this can be a positive opportunity to make services better, to improve them, and to have a look where there are faults in the system, if indeed there are faults in the system, and work out how best we're going to solve the problems. So on one level, you can be optimistic. On the other hand, I'm sure that some people will argue, for example, that maybe one of the problems with children's social care is that there's not enough involvement of the private sector. This is a time when I'm sure there will be a debate about what kind of child protection service do we want, who should deliver it, where should it sit within public services. And all this is going to happen over the next few months.
And what do you hear from social workers that you speak to or people who work in children's social care services, full stop, about what they need and what they feel needs to be done to change the way they work or the way that cases are handled?
When I've spoken to people in social work in the wake of cases like this, different people respond in different ways. For example, after Baby P, what social workers were saying was that one of the burdens of their profession was the huge amounts of paperwork that they had to do, endlessly filling in forms. There were various attempts to address that problem post-baby P. And I think one of the key things that we should do when we're thinking about how best to do safeguarding is actually make sure that that voice of the frontline social worker is heard. Let them tell us how it is to do this job. What makes their job harder? I mean, I think one key thing that we really have to talk about is the lack of resources. We've had £2 billion or so taken out of children's social care since 2010 each year. And I think the question really now has to be asked about how do we fund children's social care? Are we going to fund it properly? And how do we ensure that we have a workforce that is properly trained, that is stable, that is decently paid, that has a decent professional career path? These are some of the things that are really important and need to be discussed.
Patrick, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
That was Patrick Butler and Harry Ferguson. You can follow Patrick's reporting on this case and what happens next with the government's review at theguardian.com. The National Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children has a helpline on 0808 800 5000, or you can visit their website and make contact through there at nspcc.org.uk. Today's producers are Hannah Moore and Eva Krisiak. Sound design is by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Mythili Rao and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.
This is The Guardian.